So the subject tonight is spiritual empowerment, or in other words, be the change that you want to happen. And I think that it's a human quality to want to become better, to want to become somebody better, to want to be better, in a way to want to be somebody else. We experience frustration. We want the world to be better. We want the world to be more reasonable, not destroy itself. We want people to be more reasonable and not destroy themselves or destroy each other. We want to repair, we want tikkun olam, we want improve things. And underneath there is a deep understanding in many of us of the pain that exists in the world. And from there, we want to act and reduce pain. And many of us, we don't maybe express it like that, but I think in our hearts we feel the pain of the world, of others, of ourselves, and that motivates us to want to change ourselves and the world. It's actually the same whether we want to change the world or change ourselves. It's actually the same, because we in the world are basically one. The problem is, what tools do we have to change, to achieve this change? What are the tools that we rely on to make change? And very often, these are simply tools of thinking. We think differently. For example, we think ecologically, so we become an ecologist. We want to change the world, but it's because of a view. So then we go out and do ecology, which is fine. But it's a view. It's thinking. We want a religious life, but it's based very often on thinking. We think about God, we think about Messiah, we think about a teacher that we want, or a teaching that we want, or we read books and we get inspired, but it's still in the realm of thinking. I was amazed when I went to university and I tried to find out what I wanted to study in university, which is 1965. And there was this long list: engineering, chemistry, biology, theology. But what theology? Like, that's God in there. God, engineering, chemistry, physics, theology is study of God. What's God in the list? And then when I got to university, I got to Oxford, and I saw the people studying God, studying engineering, studying chemistry. Well, anything I knew is that there was it smelt very bad. There was a bad smell in the chemistry laboratory, and there was a rather bad smell in the God department. Very dry, old books, old rooms. Felt like people didn't wash, and certainly nobody seemed to have any fun there. So, rather dry bone smell. So it's we rely, and this world, for example, sadly relies on science to solve most of its problems. The world is collapsing, and people are trying to create new ideas based on science to somehow save the world, but the science is the problem in the first place. So they, you know, all the time we're back in circles using the same tools that we know that created the problem to try and solve the problem, because we don't have other tools. And Einstein said, you can't solve problems with the same mind that created them. It's a beautiful quote. You can't solve problems with the same mind that created them. You have to switch the mind. And another quote, a nice quote about the thinking mind is, we use the thinking mind to study reality, but all the result is that we can't understand mind or reality. The Buddha comes along and says, don't think about what you want to happen to change. Be the change. Don't think about what you want. Don't have a view that I must go and be the change. And the 10,000 suttas in the ancient texts are all instructional. None of the suttas really tell you what to believe, but they, each of them carry another tool, another toolbox, argaz kelim, a toolbox of ways of changing the self, changing the mind, changing the being, so that you become the change that you want. The Buddha also said wisely, don't try and be somebody else, because you're still then in the same state as you were before. Be trying, getting, I want to be, I want something, I want to be better. It's still the same wanting mind. You're still in the same mind. And even if you, I want the world to be better, I want the world to be better, actually you're still in the same mind of wanting, which in some ways is the problem in the first place. So there's a very subtle catch here. And the being the change, if you want the world to be more ecological, be ecology. What does it mean, be ecology? Like John Seed, this ecologist in Australia, said, be the tree, be the forest. If you are the forest, you will automatically be an ecologist. You can't be anything else. Be, if you want peace in Israel between Palestinians and Israelis, be peaceful, be peace. If you know the peace, then your actions will be peaceful. In one way or another, they will spread out. Be peaceful. Don't rage. They're terrible. They're awful. They're rage against conflict. You're part of the conflict. Your rage, zam, is a part of the conflict. So, if you want to heal others, if you want to be a healer, be whole. And then you heal. Okay, you can be a wounded healer, but in a way a wounded healer is still whole, because the healer knows his wound. So, all through the Buddhist teaching, there's powers of being, not concepts. And every time there was a lot of concepts being discussed to the Buddha or other people came and wanted to have dialogue with the Buddha on the level of concept, what is it better to be? How do you be better? The Buddha said, go and practice. Don't just have a theological dialogue. Go practice. What are the tools you use to bring to this question? What tools are you applying when you ask these questions? What are your kelim? What's tools? In many ways, what he said is also is that if you pay attention to the mind, if you work right with the mind, all the problems solve themselves. You don't really have to pay too much attention to the problems, but you have to pay a lot of attention to the mind. If you pay attention to the mind, what is the mind, purify the mind, the problems solve themselves. And it happens because you learn another way of being. If you take care of the present, as it says, then the future will look after itself. If you take care of the present, the future will take care of itself, because there really isn't anything else except your being in this present that creates the future. So take care of the meeting between the self, the mind, the me, and the world, and the rest will take care of itself. And this is why we meditate. And this is why we do other things besides meditation. Practice generosity. Practice the qualities of being. Give to others. Practice language, different language. Practice a different way of looking at things. Practice the way the eyes communicate. Practice how we are with people, like in the kitchen here. It's not just meditation. How people are practicing in the kitchen, cooking together. What does this mean? Different forms of practice. But for us here in this retreat, mostly it's meditation. We're talking about practice. And even in the Dharma world, in the Buddhist world, practice is not always so clear. In other words, there's an awful lot of non-practice in the name of Buddhism, just as there is in the name of everything else. A lot of text, reading, chanting, other things, which actually may not change us that much. But the Buddha was very, very clear. Leave things that don't change fundamentally the way you're made, the way the mind is made. Just leave them. He wasn't into chanting, or he wouldn't have been into chanting Dharma texts. I think he would have agreed with this little poem from a Japanese Zen poet who says, "Every day teachers examine the Dharma. They endlessly chant complicated suttas, texts. But before doing that, though, they should learn how to read the love letters that are sent by the wind, the rain, the snow, and the moon." So I want to discuss what's called the five powers. And the Buddhist text is really full of lists. And that's the way that people remembered 10,000 lectures of the Buddha. So it really is full of numbers. And but maybe we'll remember it also because of that too. And there's a list of spiritual powers, called the five powers. And they are powers. They give empowerment. That means ahatsama. They are powers to change the mind, but also to change our life. They're not just restricted to the meditation hall. They're about powers that we bring into our life to change the life, also to change the world as we change our life. The five powers are concentration, mindfulness, energy, trust, and wisdom. And maybe I'll give a small example how we are actually already using those powers right now before I go into them a bit more. Say that we experience coming up for us individually is something difficult, like restlessness, isheket. Okay? We experience this, isheket, restlessness in us. How do the five powers work? Well, first of all, the concentration that we were practicing all these days has allowed the unquiet to arise. The concentration is like a torch that searches out in the subconscious mind a material, and it comes up. So in that sense of quietness and space we give, the concentration allows things to arise. We want them to arise. We want to see ourselves more deeply. We may not like it, though. Up comes restlessness. So the function of concentration is like a fire that bubbles stuff that usually we keep buried underneath and closed. We close the lid. Now we put the fire. That's the concentration. The mindfulness, the second power, allows us to see, yes, here's restlessness. And it's an unpleasant feeling, and I'm with it. I study it. I see it. I see what it is. I know this is restlessness coming into the field. The energy allows us to keep going with it, not to sort of one say, it's restless, oh dear, and go off and have a cup of tea. To keep going with it, to have the energy, the power inside, the inner power, even to sit straight and be with it. Sit in our place like a rock and say, I'm ready for anything. That's energy. I'm ready. I'm not falling asleep here. I'm with my true experience. Here it is. Come on. Anything else? What's next on the menu? On the tafrit? Come on, I'm ready. I'm here. So that's energy. Sit ready for anything when we go through it. The trust is the weather inside. We've also been using it. We've also had the words and the reminders to be at home with our experience, not to be in conflict with ourselves, to be in truly at home with ourselves, to be in refuge, to take refuge. Miflat. And Simi was reminding us about the heart and the role of the heart in our practice. It's a crucial role, and she will continue with that. So the trust is an atmosphere not of conflict with ourselves. We meet the non-quiet. The last thing we want to do is have a battle inside about non-quiet. Well, that's not going to make quiet, right? So we don't want to get into battles with ourselves and judgment and anger and so on. We want a soft landing. We want to land softly. So that's trust. We trust ourselves, we trust the process, we trust the Dharma, we trust our capacity. That's the fourth of the powers. And the fifth, wisdom, is an interesting one. We're only just beginning to touch it here in the retreat in a formal way. Well, many of you already touched it informally, but in a formal way, beginning to touch the wisdom mind. The mind that says, okay, it's a phenomena, but I am bigger than this phenomena. There is Isheket coming up, there's non-quiet coming up, restlessness coming up, but I can look at the restlessness. That means I am not the restlessness. It's part, but it's not me. I have a power to look at. Therefore, part of me is free, able to look at restlessness. That's the wisdom. It means we're not identified completely with it. It means that we see it also coming and going. So, that way, the restlessness is slowly gone. It goes with this wisdom. The wisdom helps vipassana, helps to just let things go, to feel that we are bigger than the issues that come up. So I want to actually go into these powers a little bit. And the interesting thing is, these powers are spiritual powers, but they are based, and they have to be based, on the ordinary mind. That means the ordinary thinking mind is the root for the spiritual powers. For example, concentration is, and we all have it. We sit struggling with a problem in our life, when we were children or our children, and the teacher says, concentrate. And, I have to concentrate. Or a problem in mathematics. We have the capacity to concentrate. If there's a movie on television, which is really exciting movie, there's no problem in concentration. We sit through, here we sit 3/4 of an hour. If the movie is really good, we probably sit 2 hours without moving because of the concentration. We have the power of concentration, so we concentrate on a movie, we concentrate on something interesting for us, we concentrate on a book, if it's a good book, for hours. If it's a Dharma text, we concentrate for 2 minutes. uh, That's ordinary concentration. On that is the basis in which we begin to create from ordinary concentration a spiritual power called samadhi. Samadhi is non-ordinary concentration. It begins to be a power for us. And how is that? Firstly, we begin to take the concentration that is in the world, like on the television, in a book, and so on, and turn it round to us. And in some way, therefore, we benefit from it. We bring concentration back into our own mind. We apply it to ourselves. So it's quite easy to concentrate on a movie, but we don't have anything out of that experience. It doesn't help our concentration, it doesn't help our inner life. We are, in a way, lost in the movie. There is no self. We don't know that we exist when we watch a movie. We're entirely in the characters, the story, we're not here, actually. We're there, in the movie. So it doesn't really help us. We're out, stuck in the world. The mind is in the story. And the story takes the mind away. So the mind doesn't actually have to do any work. And the mind isn't part of the picture. So we apply concentration to ourselves. Then we build some power of being steady with our own experience. Consciously steady. Steadiness and becomes conscious. Right? Aware. We are aware of steadiness. It becomes part of our consciousness. As we a little bit withdraw from the world, retreat is in English is nisiga, right? So it's a withdrawal. A little bit we withdraw into the retreat situation. It's an example. Withdrawal from the world a little bit and turn the light on ourselves, on our honest experience. And we this way create in ourselves slowly stability, yitzivut, steadiness, inner peace, quiet. We belong to the ground we stand on. There's some solid sense of inner peace and steadiness that we get from this concentration, and therefore ordinary concentration becomes a spiritual power, becomes samadhi, which we then use in our life. When the whole world is going mad around us, that's the spiritual power we need to be steady in the middle of the craziness, whatever it is. People, arguments, fights, whatever, the street, the bus queue, the whole story. Concentration allows us to have inner peace and steadiness. We stand on our ground and we are there, steady. And it's an important power that we use spiritually and in daily life. Everything we're learning here, we take to daily life. And it helps us in every possible situation. We are less scattered, pizur, mefuzar. We are less easy, knocked down. We have more. The Buddha, in the last words before he died, he said, be an island to yourself. An island means be autonomy, be, I would sort of call it, inner independence, be steady, be an island, strong. So that's the concentration. Mindfulness is also based on ordinary attention. Attention. We know we attend. We put our attention somewhere. We place our attention. We're driving. We place our attention on the road. We place our attention on the idiot drivers on the left side and the right side. If we didn't place our attention there, we wouldn't last 5 minutes on Israeli roads. So we are placing our attention in an active way, and we have plenty of attention. If we drive 3 hours, think of how much attention we have. We're focused totally. We are concentrated as well. We know everything's going on. And we're talking. And we're listening to Galei Tzahal on the radio. That's a lot of attention. So we have the power of attention. Mindfulness takes that another stage into a spiritual power. It's being present. It's taking all that attention and again putting it here and expanding it into other areas. We expand the attention to our feet that we don't normally notice, into our hands, into our breath, into a taste of supper, into the, you know, if we are doing the practice, we're sitting on the toilet. We're not thinking of something else. We are right there. We go to sleep. We wake up in the morning right there. We place attention in all moments of our life. And this is creates a radical shift. It's called ordinary magic. Meaning, the ordinary things of life become magic, become special, become unique. This moment will never happen again. But we won't know that unless we pay attention to it. This moment is only this moment exists. It will never ever happen again. And it's amazing. So that's a spiritual power, mindfulness. It helps us to make life, which is looks sometimes like a flat plateau of daily life, on and on and on, and you know, tayas automati, just on. It makes that become full of mountains and valleys and lakes and trees and stars and sun and moon and the love letters, as I was reading from the wind and the snow. I had a class of doctors. Several of us teachers had a class of doctors. We were teaching mindfulness and meditation to doctors in Maccabi, Kupat Cholim. And I was really trying to find images and ways of helping them to understand what we're doing. And the one thing I think that really got home to the doctors was I asked them, you know, how much do you notice about your patients when they walk in the room? You have 30 patients a day, or 40. It's really difficult. And you have them the next day, and the next day, and the next day. So the tendency is to shut off. But what happened if you didn't shut off? What would you see? Would you see how a patient walked through the door? Would you be able to get a sense of his disease or his problem before he opened his mouth? Would you be able to feel with your heart this person's energy, this person? How can you imagine doing that? And what would you need to do that? And of course, mindfulness. It's this being awake to this new situation. Okay, 40 patients come through the door, but we did, you know, 1,000 breaths today. So there's 1,000 opportunities to be mindful. 40 patients is 40 human beings, an opportunity to be mindful. And given this language, they really begin to understand it. They began to understand it. And it's how mindfulness helps us in our life. The power of now. It's called the power. The power of now, this book by Eckhart Tolle. It's a power to be in the now, to notice what's really going on, to take it to pieces, to have every moment fully there, fully awake. That's mindfulness. And it goes everywhere. We had a session the other night on prayer and meditation, and how with Rabbi Yehoshua Engelman, and we had a session at Beit Sangha in Tel Aviv, an evening, a very wonderful evening, where we discussed together meditation and prayer and how they're different and how they're separate and so on. And it really is, if we're mindful as we pray, then the prayer is different. And of course, the opposite is happening. If we pray mindfully, if we put prayer into mindfulness, the mindfulness is also different. It reminds me of a story I heard years ago about two monks. I don't know if I can get it right, but we'll see. Two Christian monks that were debating together whether they're allowed to smoke cigarettes. So they didn't know. So they said, let's write a letter to the Pope. And say, oh, that's a good idea. Let's write a letter to the Pope. So they wrote a letter to the Pope. 2 weeks later, they came back and said, did you get an answer? Yes, yes, I got an answer. What's your answer? He said, I couldn't smoke. Oh, well, I got an answer. And he said, I could smoke. So what did you write? Said, I asked if I could smoke while praying. And he said, no. And I said, ah, I asked if I could pray while smoking. And he said, yes. There's another story somewhat similar about that I heard from actually also a rabbi. Someone came into Beit Knesset to pray on a Shabbat. It was a visitor. And he came into the Beit Knesset, and the rabbi came down and said, Baruch Haba, Shalom, sit down, welcome. So he sat down. After 10 minutes, the rabbi came to him again and said, Baruch Haba, welcome. After another 10 minutes, around 5 minutes, the rabbi came again and said, Baruch Haba, welcome. He did it 30 times during the course of one Shabbat prayer. And at the end, he went to the rabbi and said, how? Yeah, I understand you welcoming me one time, but 30 times in the course of the morning? He said, yeah. Every time you went away somewhere else, and then you came back again, I said, Baruch Haba, welcome. And you kept going off and kept coming back again. So, being present, and it's a spiritual power. In some way, if we have a religious mind, and if we want to use the God language, we need to be present if we seek God's presence. We can't find God's presence in the world if we ourselves are not present. So it has a very important power for us in our spiritual life, mindfulness. Another quality which mindfulness we talked a lot about already, and a lot of instruction about it. The concentration we talked a lot about already, and we've had a lot of instruction. Energy we didn't talk about very much. It's also based on ordinary energy. Ordinary energy is often about goals, about achievements. I want to get done the job. I need this. I want to get that. I want to get that. That gives us a lot of energy. Some people have a huge energy coming out of determination to succeed. Morning, noon and night, they don't sleep and so on. They're really trying to get something, and big energy comes from this. But that's the ordinary mind, and it's the ordinary energy. The spiritual power of energy is different. It gets more subtle. It's less driven. You know what I mean? Driven. Less pushy. From wanting to gain as a source of energy, gradually it changes to motivation. Gradually it changes to intention. And then gradually it changes simply to a kind of sustainable, balanced energy. And we can't go in to meditation or spiritual practice in a driven kind of mode of ordinary energy. We can't go into it with achievement mode, because it's not sustainable. And it also creates a lot of tension and stress and difficulty and struggle, and can often make it much more difficult. So we don't encourage it at least in there is a lot of it in the tradition. We don't encourage this pushy energy in the practice here, at least. The famous story of the lute, the musician, the Buddha was on the bank of the river, and along came a boat with a boatman and a sitar teacher and a student. The Buddha was in a stage of great ascetic practice, didn't eat, practicing intensively, driving himself. And he heard the sitar teacher say to the student, "If you tighten the strings too much, it doesn't make music. If the strings are too loose, it doesn't make music. If they're just right, it makes music." And it's just right. That means an energy without friction, chikuch, without resistance, without driving, this just right is the spiritual energy. And that's an energy that is sustainable. That can keep us going in our practice for years, for days, or whatever. It's just sustainable. We can keep going. We're not burnt out. And it collapsed after a meditation course. I just went on a meditation course. Now I need a holiday, for God's sake. The middle way, the energy is often used as a good example of Shvil Zahav, the middle way in our spiritual life. Because if there's too much driving, pushing, I want to succeed, then we burn out. If there's too little, we go to sleep and it doesn't happen. So this middle way is the middle way of the Dharma. The Buddhist way is often called the middle way because there's a balance, and energy is a good example of this. A little poem from Rumi. Keep knocking on the door. The joy inside will eventually open a window and look out to see who is there. Keep knocking on the door. The joy inside eventually will open a window and look out to see who is there. So we just keep knocking on the door, and the joy looks out at us. That's the energy. So the fourth is trust. And trust, in a way, ordinary mind of trust is in the territory of belief. I believe in the Buddha. I believe everything my teacher tells me. I believe in the rabbi. I need to go to the rabbi to know whether to take a bus or a taxi. I believe everything he says. I believe in the rightness of my people, my cause. We're always right. God is on our side, etc. Beliefs. And the Buddha didn't encourage beliefs at all, including beliefs in the Buddha. The Buddha said belief is not helpful. It's the ordinary mind, again. It goes with a lot of hope and wanting, and it goes with a lot of other things. Belief moves slowly to trust. And trust is something very deep in us, in which we feel that the world is not against us. Trust is a kind of inner weather. It's a kind of softness about us and our life. We trust ourselves, our capacity. We trust others. We have a sort of inner smile. It's a very powerful thing. I remember that some years ago, we did a project of bringing Israelis to Nablus to work with Palestinians on dialogue and making contact and making peace between individuals. And there was a lot of discussion how much it works and how much if it worth it or it's not worth it and so on. But one of the things that moved all of us very, very deeply and in a way made the whole thing worth it, despite a huge effort and many difficulties, was that again and again and again, we heard from the Palestinians who we came there, we made the effort, we came there, overcoming fears and everything to them and slept in their houses in their territories. And again they said, we suffered so much, and the big problem is that us and our children lose hope in human beings. We have a model of human beings that the children grow up, which is that human beings are hard and evil and just soldiers and just oppression and so on and so on and so on. You coming show us that human beings are not bad. You're coming here, show us that there is good in the human soul. And that's something we carry with us for our life. It brings us hope. It brings us positivity. So on a very subtle level, it was very powerful what we did, although politically it wasn't very dramatic. So slowly, slowly, we begin to feel when we trust, when we build trust, that life is our refuge. Miflat, miklat. We feel that life is not against us. Life itself is a refuge. Never mind what happens. And it's a very important ingredient for going out into the world. Because if we go out into the world with not trusting anybody, looking over our shoulder all the time, who's after us, who's against me, who doesn't like, it's a very difficult place in order to help others. We need trust in order to help others, and trust in order to help ourselves. Thought about it a lot, because I have some chickens, and there's always snakes. And snakes arrive in the chickens, and I sometimes get up in the morning, and I go to the chickens, say good morning to them, and there is a snake. Looking at me, I look at it. It's either a black snake, or a tsefa, or an adder. And that's when you need trust. And the usual trust is not to do anything against the snake, but to trust the snake wants to survive, you want to survive, the chickens want to survive, and we'll sort ourselves we'll sort ourselves out somehow. It'll all be sorted out. I think walking meditation is a wonderful practice to not to get bitten by snakes. Snakes want to get out of the way. They don't. So if you trust that everything will be fine and you walk slowly, you'll be fine. No snake will ever do anything to you. So you trust snakes to get out of the way. But I think in the life also you trust. You can trust, and it works. Trust works. It's a power, and it changes things. It softens things. And it's a powerful agent for change to others and to yourself. It's a basis of compassion. Chemla, which is one of the major Buddhist themes. Trust is needed for chemla, for compassion. When you extend trust, it becomes compassion and heartfulness. So the fifth power is wisdom. And wisdom also is based on an ordinary mind. The ordinary mind version of wisdom is intelligence. We are intelligent. We think about things. We know, we understand things. We're listening to sort of half-intelligent Dharma talk right now. So we're intelligent. We know things. We understand. Mind is working. And we have a huge mind. We reflect. We think, we learn. And wisdom takes this further and says, wisdom isn't just in thought. Wisdom doesn't lie in thought. Wisdom, or panya, lies in a deeper kind of knowing. For example, when we have issues or we have problems that come up, we have problems that we deal with, we can apply the wisdom that says they don't belong 100% to me. They're not all mine. Like a problem of, I said, quietness. It's come because of reasons. A deep understanding that things are created because of reasons. Reasons, conditions, come and create result. They're not only on my shoulders, everything. Everything that happens to me is not just mine. I don't have to own balut on everything that happens. Things happen by themselves. That's a wisdom. It's a wisdom that frees us. And it's not in thought. The wisdom that says, things are changing all the time, and things are flowing, and things are moving. And I don't know where, I can't cut. It's all changing. A field of change in life. Undefinable. I can't exactly define it. I can't describe it. I can't put it in a box. That's a wisdom. It's not in thought. It's not philosophy. It's here, in the heart mind. We just understand. It's tovana. A moment of realization. Oh, things, because of this, that happens. It's a realization. You can't really put it into words. So, the wisdom is about seeing the nature of things, insight, intuition, sense of inner freedom. That's wisdom. And based on the thinking mind, taking it further into awareness, understanding, contact, feeling the big mind in us, feeling connection, relationship, sensing things. That's where the wisdom comes in, and it's a wonderful quality. It transforms everything that happens to us, transforms difficulty into learning experience. But all the difficulties we might have had in this hall of boredom, of isheket, of anger, of aversion, of whatever. With the eye of wisdom, they dissolve. They're not on me, they're not so heavy on me, they're just experiences that come and go. I'm with them. It needs a wisdom for that. Rumi says, keep knocking on the door to heaven. Well, I kept knocking on the door to heaven. It opened. I found myself on the inside. I kept knocking on the door to heaven. It opened. I was on the inside. So, the final word. The powers need somehow to be in balance. It's helpful for the five powers and all our powers to be in balance. But nevertheless, we're going to have each of us our speciality. There'll be one person that has more wisdom, one person that has more energy, one person that has more. I mean, you could consider which is your type. We all have a type. Maybe a mindfulness type, or a energy type, or a wisdom type, or a trust type, or a concentration type. And it's okay. And also, we can't do everything at once. So in the retreat itself, we started with concentration, and gradually adding more mindfulness all the time, and then gradually adding more trust and more wisdom. So we can't do everything all at once. But in the end, in our journey, these powers need to be in balance. For example, if we have too much trust without the wisdom, it becomes blind. We just trust, or we go back to belief, or we believe in the Messiah, or we believe it can lead to extremism. We trust what somebody tells us, the old men or the guru or the rabbi or the prime minister or whatever we believe, we trust, is too much. We need the wisdom to be able to say, wait a minute, what's going on here? So trust without wisdom can lead to extremism, kitsoniyut, and also some kind of dream illusion. And wisdom without trust is very analytic, becomes just like thinking, but rather hard and lonely. It doesn't have the trust in it. It doesn't have the heart in it. And concentration by itself can be very make us blank out, kind of just to be blank and not really engaged in life. And so we need to balance the concentration with mindfulness and with wisdom. So these qualities need to be balanced. Mindfulness, if it's too much by itself, can often bring up problems. We don't have the power to deal with them because we don't have the wisdom to deal with the problems. The mindfulness generates insight. We see things, but we can't really deal with them or transform ourselves because we need the wisdom. So these powers need to be in balance. It's just a final word to consider. And gradually we learn them and we apply them in our practice. And sometimes you might think about it when you practice yourself, just to be aware, well, okay, this is the time for trust. Well, this is the time for the wisdom eye to see what I'm learning here. And this is the time my concentration is weak. I need to be more concentrated. So knowing, playing with a little bit with the powers. So that's what I want to say. Thank you about the five powers. So let's take a few minutes.